Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Maria Altman. Don Marsh is away. It's that time of year again. It's tax season. The deadline for filing with the IRS is in about 2 months. Here to help guide us through the process of filing state and federal tax returns is CPA Lance Weiss of SFW Partners. And yes, he's here to talk about one of life's certainties, taxes. We want to take your questions about filing state and federal tax returns. You can give us a call at 314-382-8255. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on Air. Lance Weiss, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me today.
So what's the biggest change you've seen between this year and last year in terms of filing tax returns?
Well, in terms of filing the tax returns, we've got a different due date this year, April 18th, but that's not really too much of a new thing. A date that's already passed, it was actually, I think today or yesterday, they did start finally issuing refunds if you were doing the earned income tax credit or had a refundable child tax credit. So that was new. They were delaying those in the hopes of preventing some of the mass identity theft that was going on. So that's a new thing. But I would say the most different question I get is, how will things be different next year?
You know,
what are all the changes going to be? And of course, no one knows yet. And as we were talking earlier, I haven't been on Twitter in a few hours, so I'm not sure what all those changes are yet. So
it could be lots of big changes in terms of tax rates.
There will be. And, you know, it's been about 30 years since we've had a substantive tax change. When I was in school, we learned about the Internal Revenue Code of 1954. And then Ronald Reagan rewrote that as the Internal Revenue Code of 1986. Well, that was 32 years. And we're coming up on that 32-year break. And now there's an alignment with the president, the House, and the Senate. And that tends to be when substantive change can happen. And we'll see what comes out of it.
But for right now,
that's right. We face an impending due date of April 18th this year. So.
Well, I wanted to ask about you know, most people do get tax refunds, and I was looking up some information this morning, and out of 152 million returns processed last year, 111 million got a refund, which is kind of incredible to me, and the average was around $2,800. But getting a return, it feels great, but it's not necessarily the best way to be managing your money.
Yeah, well, there are a couple different definitions of best. And if saving that $2,800 or having that available for the family vacation or whatever it might be, if you do have too much withheld and then you get a refund, it is kind of that forced savings plan. Now, from a strict financial planning aspect or look at it, what you're doing there is you're giving a tax-free loan to the government. They're holding your money and then paying you back with no interest. But in today's environment of, you know, fractional interest payments, you know, there are different definitions of best.
So. Right. You're not going to be making lots and lots of money.
Exactly. Not in today's banking environment. No.
Right. Well, let's go to the phones. We've got a call from Maureen in St. Genevieve. And Maureen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, I am a Missouri native, but I've lived other places through most of my life. I retired this year and returned. And so this is my first time in ages to fill out a Missouri income tax form. I had earnings up through May in Maryland, and then starting in June, I had my Social Security and a small part-time job income here in Missouri. What do I put down as my Missouri income?
Okay, so Missouri will first of all include all of your income. However, what you're going to need to do is a part-year return. So only the income that you earned after you moved to Missouri and made that your home state will be subject to Missouri income tax. So the part of the year that you were in Maryland won't be included. And the form you're going to look for is a MO-NRI, and that's where your non-resident income will be – or rather, your income will be broken out between your non-resident time period and your resident time period.
That's terrific. Also, I did cash in retirement fund, and all of it was paid to me after I had returned to Missouri, and those where I had worked had told me they only took out Missouri taxes on the full amount. So can you tell me what form I'll use when I fill out my Missouri form to claim that?
Or? Sure. So a couple of forms there. The general MO 1040 is where all the income is going to go. But then there's a MO-A, And on the Mo-A, there are some very important exemptions for retirement income that, depending on the source of the retirement, it might not be taxed in Missouri. So you know, depending on the phase-outs and the source of income, you might find yourself with some good news there.
Oh, that would be lovely.
Thanks, Maureen.
And welcome back to Missouri.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Okay.
Well, in talking about retirement, one of the things that people who are need to contribute to their IRA and they maybe didn't get it done in calendar 2016, they're still able to do that through April 15th?
Through April 18th, actually.
Okay.
So, yeah, the retirement plans are still a great way to save for retirement and also save some current income taxes. Now, you can make a regular IRA contribution, and that is deductible from your income tax. Or you could make a Roth IRA deduction. Now, that's not deductible from your income tax, but then when you pull the funds out, both what you put in and your earnings on that aren't subject to income tax down the road. So the Roth IRA can be a good option for some people. There's also a saver's credit that's available. So for a lot of people, if their income's under that, say, $25,000, $30,000 level, if they can afford to put some money into their retirement plan, then the government can actually give you back a credit on top of that. So
oh, wow.
Not only a deduction and also a credit. So the saver's credit is an important saver out there.
That's great. Well, let's hear from Kelly from St. Louis. Hi, Kelly. Hi, Kelly, are you there?
I am.
Hi, what's your question?
I have just had my taxes done through the AARP. I don't have to pay anything. I'm on full disability, and so when we netted out the numbers, I didn't need to pay anything to Missouri or the feds, but I'm concerned about the city. Do I need to file something with the city, even though I'm not making enough to file for the federal or Missouri?
Right. So the city has an earnings tax, and it's generally on a form. It's an E-1 is the city form. There's another form that's a city E-234, which I don't think that one would apply to you. But it generally only taxes the earnings that a person has. So your pension income, your disability income should be tax-free there. Without knowing what the whole return looks like, I can't say for sure that you don't have a filing requirement, but based on that little bit of information, I think you're fine in the city as well.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kelly. And let's talk a little bit about the earned income tax credit. You know, for folks who might be moderate or lower income, working individuals, the earned income tax or tax credit is really something that they should know about.
Yeah, it is. The EITC has been around for a long time, and for those lower income folks, if they have two, three, I think the benefit might stop at about three children, but it can be up to an additional $5,000 or almost $5,500 that can come back. So the form EITC is an important benefit to work through. Fortunately, in today's world, we all use the software. That's one of those forms that would be a struggle to try to do by hand because it's so integrated with the tables and the benefit. But certainly those with lower income, and you don't have to have kids to benefit from the EITC, but certainly with children, claiming them as a dependent, the benefit's even greater.
And sometimes a person who may not even owe taxes can still get that credit?
Yeah, it's what's called a refundable credit. So even though your income might be offset with the standard deduction or other itemized deductions or personal exemptions to where you don't have an income tax liability, because it is a refundable credit, they'll pay you back funds with that as well.
Worth knowing.
Yeah, and again, it's up to, I think it's $5,572 or somewhere up at that level. It's indexed a little bit each year. And that was a big source of the fraud and the identity theft that was going on. So one of the things that the government did for this filing season is they slowed down the refunds on anyone claiming the EITC. And it was really just this week did they start to process and then issue those refunds.
Okay. And let's see. We've got Sue from St. Louis who has a question. Sue, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. I was just wondering about what caregiver expenses are deductible. We do care for my mom almost 24/7. We have some hired help, and we share it amongst family members as well.
Okay, so the medical expenses are deductible, but there's a floor to get over the medical expenses. until you spend more than 10% of your adjusted gross income, you won't realize the benefit for those medical expenses. The other hurdle to get over when you have a number of children pooling together to take the deductions or spending the money for a parent is that the expenses need to be for a dependent. So it could be such that, you know, your mom is claiming herself on her own return. Well, she can benefit from those deductions, but she might not be in an overall taxable situation anyway. And I know what we'll see with some of our clients is that their other income from either their job or even a spouse's job might be such that they're not spending enough to get over that 10% hurdle to get any benefit from the deductions. The place to start to determine if any of that will be deductible would be on the Schedule A. That's where the itemized deductions would come into play. But I'm not optimistic that they will actually yield a benefit.
Okay. And I guess we were wondering if meal expenses, sometimes the caregivers, the higher caregivers will eat meals with my mom. Are their meals deductible as well? Or?
Well, so if your mom is in a full-skill nursing care center, then pretty much all of those costs are deductible. When it's home care, it gets a higher hurdle to overcome to have the meals deductible. You know, they would need to be somehow ordered by a doctor, that the caregiver needs to be there 24 hours a day. But even in that respect, I mean, the caregiver needs to eat anyway. So the meals would most likely not qualify as a deduction, but certainly the direct cost for your mom's care would qualify.
Okay. All righty. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sue. And we're going to take just a moment. We'll be back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. This is St. Louis on the Air, and we're talking with CPA Lance Weiss about filing tax returns. If you have a question, give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. And Lance, I know one of the things that people are in the last couple of years have really been concerned about is the Affordable Health Care Act minimum essential coverage and letting the government know whether they have health insurance, and if they don't, whether they can get an exemption or if they might have to pay a penalty.
Yeah, it is a big area, because if you fail to include all of the right forms with your 2015 return, then it could have been hard to get health insurance in 2016. The exchange would have said, well, where's your premium reconciliation? And they might not, you know, just more hurdles to get over to get the insurance. So certainly including all of that information on your return so that you can get insurance next year is vitally important. Then, as you mentioned, also because of the penalties. Those penalties are in force. They are there on the 2016 returns. But again, that could be a change as what would happen in 2015 on the 17 returns. A couple of forms that the people need to have in order to get that portion of their return correct is the copy of the 1095 that they received. Now, if they bought their insurance on the exchange will make available to them through the website, or more likely you would have received it in the mail, the form 1095A. And on the 1095A, it'll show you bought the insurance on the exchange, you had coverage either all year or for these months. And then many people who buy their insurance on the exchange receive a subsidy or an advanced premium tax credit that their insurance might otherwise be $300 a month. Maybe they get a credit and they only have to go out of pocket $200 a month to get that. Well, that's an estimate, that credit is. So then what they need to do on their return is file a Form 8962 to reconcile the estimate that they received when they bought the insurance to what their income actually turned out to be. So that Form 8962, again, so happy we have software, because it's another one of those forms where, holy cow, to do the math on that would be monstrously time-consuming. But the 1095A is vitally important because it'll have all that premium tax credit information on there. Now, if you get your insurance from your employer, it's likely that you will have received a Form 1095B or a 1095C. The information there is also vitally important to put on your return, because that's the proof to the government that you had insurance. So you need to get that information on your return, and then that box that's somewhere around line 50 on the form that says, I had insurance, I have my form, don't charge me a penalty, that's the big saver there.
Speaking of software, I think we have a question that deals with some of those software. This is from St. Louis. I believe it's Liberia. Hi, Liberia. Are you there?
Yes. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right. What I was concerned about is the safety or the security of the TurboTax. And also, I did use TurboTax last year, and I might have made some mistakes. I wanted to know, how do I go back to maybe do a back check or a soft audit for my filing?
Okay. So the individual software companies, I think, have all done a great job with their security. Now, that's not to say that no one's identity will ever be, lost or stolen because of that. But I think all the vendors have to go through a process with the IRS where their systems and their backups and their security are all checked. The IRS goes to great lengths to try to make sure all those are safe. But, of course, none of us are ever safe in this world of cyber issues. Now, on the return that might have had a mistake, or maybe a deduction was missed, or maybe some income wasn't reported, the way to fix that, if that ends up being the case, is to file a form 1040X, would be the amended form. And again, IRS.gov has all these forms available. And it's not a hard form. It basically, in the first column, it says, this is what I reported. Here's the change. This is what the new number would be. And then page 2 is just space for the written explanation. I forgot to include some itemized deductions or whatever it might be. It's actually a well-designed form that's relatively easy to use, and the IRS gets millions of these amended returns. So don't worry that, oh my gosh, if I file the amended return, are they going to come audit me? Well, they never tell us what gives rise to an audit, but I don't think that's one of them.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Liberia. And we've got an email from Kelly. What health insurance forms do you still need to file? Could this go away if you no longer have to pay a penalty for not having health insurance under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, so if you have the 1095A where you bought the insurance on the exchange, then you will need to file the form 8962 to do that reconciliation. So that's the only form that actually has to go with the return if you bought it on the exchange. The ones to keep in your possession would be the 1095Bs and Cs, and that's your proof. And there's a box you check on page 2 of the 1040 that says, I had coverage all year, don't charge me a penalty. And the IRS also gets copies of the 1095s electronically from whoever puts them together. So they'll match those up in theory, and then when they match those up, they'll know that, okay, Kelly from St. Louis had insurance and no penalties charged to her.
All right. Let's go to Georgia in St. Louis. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have been a Missouri resident for all of 2016. However, I switched jobs halfway through the year, and I now work remotely for a company based in New York State. They take out New York State taxes from my paycheck, not Missouri, and I know that there's going to be a difference when I go ahead and file for 2016. I was just curious what forms or maybe the process would be on that.
Well, depending on how you're working remotely, how often do you get to New York? Is it a kind of thing where you have to go to the home office often enough, or is it really truly remotely?
No, it's really truly remotely.
Okay. Well, you are still working in Missouri, and what the employer in New York should be doing is withholding Missouri income tax.
Okay.
So that's the hard part of that answer, because now you've got to get back with that HR department with the company in New York. They're going to have to register in Missouri, and it's, could be a process.
Okay.
So now to get that, what the company might tell you or might ask you to do is, listen, could you just file the New York return, tell them you're working in Missouri, and then New York will send you a refund, and then when you do your Missouri return, you're going to owe Missouri tax. Certainly another option, but if you're W-2, on the bottom part of the W-2, there's going to be a state code. And if that state code says New York, then the state of New York got a copy of that as well. And they will be looking for your New York return. So if the company says, listen, it's too much of a burden, we really don't want to reissue the W-2, then you would just file in New York, get the refund, and then file in Missouri and pay the Missouri tax.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay. I was also curious, because I work from home, is there any sort of tax credit I can claim for the space in my home that I use solely for my work?
Okay, so it wouldn't be a tax credit, but there is a tax deduction for using your home office. And the form there, I don't have all these forms committed to memory. If you Google home office form, it'll pop up. It's an 88-something, 8829 maybe, or something like that. But just Google home office form and it'll pop up. Now, to claim the home office as an employee, it has to be for the convenience of the employer, and that's certainly the case with the New York employer. But then the other hurdle is that the space needs to be used exclusively for the home office. So if you're working on your dining room table and it's also your dining room table, then that area or portion of the home won't qualify.
Okay.
But if it is really a separate bedroom, or you built an office in the basement or whatever it might be, then mm-hmm. it would be a square footage test. Or what the IRS gave us a couple of years ago is a simplified home office deduction, where you just take $5 per foot for whatever the square footage is, and then you can take that as a deduction. So that's the good news part of that. The bad news is, as an employee, that home office deduction is part of your itemized deductions. So then from there, it's going to go up to your Schedule A. And there are a couple of hurdles on the Schedule A that might prevent the actual benefit of that cost. But again, it's certainly something to work through if you're already itemizing deductions and have any of the other employee-type expenses. You certainly want to try. So start with the home office. As an employee, you would also need a Form 2106 to summarize all of your employee business expenses. But every little bit helps. So you might end up with a little bigger tax refund that way.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I appreciate the advice.
Yep, thank you. And let's go to Dave in Wildwood. Dave, are you there?
My question is in reference to the alternative minimum tax. My wife and I were dual income. We gross, depending upon the year, between $190,000 to $200,000 a year. Our kids are grown or older. They're in college. We're paying for all the college. We don't take any withholding out on our checks. And we have very little and we max out our 401k. We have very little in mortgage interest. We've got about 6 to 7 years left on our mortgage. And because we're paying so much to the kids for their college, three kids, we're not really able to save a lot of money. And every year we get hit with the alternative minimum tax, and it costs me between $8,000 and $12,000 a year that I end up having to pay in additional taxes. Are there any strategies or anything I can do to avoid this situation?
Yeah, the AMT is really, first of all, it's misnamed. It shouldn't be called the alternative minimum tax. It ought to be called the alternative maximum tax, because when it's higher, you have to pay it. And you're right in that income range. Generally, those between like 180 up to almost 300 in income just get crushed by this alternative minimum tax. And just kind of in general, but for the rest of the audience, what that tax is a second completely separate tax calculation where you get no benefit for your real estate taxes, you get no benefit for your state income taxes, no benefit for claiming the kids as dependents. So that's all the bad news. And then they subject it to, for some taxpayers, a slightly lower tax rate, because the max AMT bracket's 28%. Well, if your income's in that 200 range anyway and you have those other deductions, your regular tax bracket, for the most part, is going to be in the 25% range. So the AMT is certainly a punishing tax, and you're right in the thick of it right there. Now, you mentioned a couple of things that you're doing right, which are deductions for the AMT tax. The 401k and maxing that out is certainly a good way to go. Since you're in a 401k and your income's as high as it is, you'd be prohibited from making another deductible IRA contribution, so that one's not going to work. Mortgage interest is deductible, but I hate to encourage someone to go out and get more debt when you're only 6 years away from having the whole house paid off. But the only deductions really allowed for the AMT are charitable contributions, and you got charitable contributions and 401k type deductions, mortgage interest, but you know, your big deductions will be your real estate tax, your state income tax, and your kids, and all those are lost.
So, right.
There's
really no strategy.
Yeah, I mean,
is there any discussion about eliminating it with any tax revisions or?
Well, you know, part of the Trump tax platform is really short on details. But one of the things that he's talked about is eliminating the alternative minimum tax. But then again, at the same time, he's talked about reducing the rate structure, eliminating the deductions for kids, and then capping the overall benefit of your itemized deductions. So there's a very real argument out there that, yeah, he's going to repeal the AMT tax, but then he's going to make the regular tax system so close to what the AMT tax system already is that it's going to be the new system that he have will be a blend of what we have now, and it'll not be too far from what the AMT tax is.
Gotcha.
So it'll be repealed. It'll be replaced with something that doesn't look too much different than what it is now. You know, that there are some projections out there that under the Trump plan, when a person's income is right around the $200,000 level, I've seen some projections on this, your savings will be in the $1,000 to $2,000 range. So there will be some tax relief for folks up in that bracket. And really, at the IRS just recently released some statistics on income. And at that 190 to 200 level, you're above that 10% cutoff. So of those 150 million returns that get filed, you're in the top 15 million there. And when I tell that to my clients, they say, well, I don't feel like I'm in the top 10% wealthy group. But, you know, you look at the 150 million returns that are filed and really, you know, big congratulations there. So way to go.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Thanks for the call. And let's go with Darrell in Belleville. And I hope I'm saying your name correctly.
Yes, you are.
Oh, great. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi. I had a question about, I have a home-based business that I just started last year, and I have no profit after overhead. I do use my whole home for storage and everything of supplies. So am I able to still make deductions even though I don't have a profit to speak of?
Well, so the IRS is going to balk a little bit at using the whole home for your business. I mean, there could be because in any area that's used jointly, for example, the kitchen would be an area that wouldn't qualify for part of the business deduction because, you know, it's where you are. And your main bedroom where you're sleeping wouldn't qualify to be eligible for that home office deduction. So not all of the home can be for business use, but it sounds like certainly a big portion of it is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no requirement that a home-based business shows a profit. I mean, many times when they're starting out like yours are, they're going to show a loss in the first couple of years. And it could be important to do that return, file that return anyway, because those losses can be carried over to future years so you can pay less income tax on your 17 return.
Okay. I was confused. And if I didn't make a profit, I didn't think I could add it to any income. So I did have a lot of overhead to pay for. To repay back, and I was kind of lost on that, and I didn't want to have to, you know, I want to file it by myself online, and so
yeah.
I didn't know if I need to do a professional since I didn't have an income.
Well, you know, when you go to do that online, where you're going to report that other business income and that operation is going to be on a form Schedule C, so you're going to be sure you go through that form, and again, take every deduction you possibly can, because that loss could create what's called a net operating loss, and then you can use that to either offset income from another source or carry it over to next year and pay less tax next year.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Darrell.
All right, thank you, guys.
And we have a lot of, you know, self-employed people who are looking at how to do their taxes. And I think we're going to speak with an Uber driver here. Stephen is from St. Louis. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, my question is, I started driving Uber last year as a second income. Because all my money goes to my mortgage and home, I'm kind of house poor here. But I know I have to use a 1099 form. But I made like $7,000, just a little over $7,000 last year driving Uber. However, I had expenses like a car payment, $576, car insurance, and my phone. I use my phone also for the Uber service and gas and basically maintenance on my car. Are those deductibles from that income that I earn that I can use and perhaps offset some of my expenses?
Yes, without a doubt they are. But they're going to be deductible on a percentage basis. So with Uber, they I would imagine they track how many total miles you drove to earn the $7,000, or do they just give you a report by person?
Oh, no, they do the miles, too. Okay. I do have the miles in there as well, yes.
Okay, great. So you know exactly what all of your business miles are at that point. And then,
yes,
and then, yeah, so you have all your business miles, you know your total miles, so you come up with that percentage. And then what you can do is look at the total cost that you had driving the car, and then take the percentage of that number as a deduction. Now, instead of using the car payment, they make you use auto depreciation. And there's a table there you can pick up on a form 4562 that, you know, might be a little higher, might be a little less, depending on the cost of the car, rather than the car payment. So you're going to want to do depreciation on the 4562. Or you could take the standard mileage rate, which is certainly a whole lot easier to calculate. And that, I think, for last year was right around that 56-cent level, but that's Google's got that one at the tip of their fingers, too.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you, Stephen, very much for the call.
Thank you.
And very quickly, we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask, you know, oftentimes people are interested in how they can get their refund the quickest way. What's your advice on that?
Yeah, so the direct deposit of the refund is the best way to go. And of course, e-filing your return and then requesting an electronic direct deposit. But you want to make sure you double-check both the routing number and the account number that'll be on page 2 of the return, because that's the account the money's going in. So you want to be sure you put
sure
your
you get the
account.
Right number.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And, yep. And it's averaging about 3-4 weeks?
You know, I would say probably faster than that. The IRS says they always take 2 to 3 weeks to return the refunds, but, you know, oftentimes we'll e-file a return on a Monday and they've got the money before a week's up.
All right. Well, Lance Weiss, thank you so much for being with us and giving us great tax advice.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.